Who is the Martian Emperor? When a giant airship descends on New York City in 1892 and threatens destruction if the world does not submit to the Martian flag, it's up to the mysterious Smith, inventor and adventurer, to find out what forces are at work. To stop the menace, they'll need to enlist the help of Theodore Roosevelt and other early 20th century heroes. It's the second book in Andrew Mayne's The Chronological Man series, and the Martian Emperor combines mystery, airship battles, and backroom Tammany Hall politics, all against the backdrop of a world on the verge of war. You can buy it for only $1 at Amazon or Nook, coming soon to Apple iBooks. It's Andrew Mayne's The Chronological Man, The Martian Emperor, available now on ebook. This is a free audiobook presentation of The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist by Andrew Mayne, read by Justin Robert Young. If you would like to download the full ebook for only 99 cents, head on over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's Nook store or Apple's iBooks. If you are enjoying this presentation, head on over to the Amazon listing for The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist, and remember to leave a review. We appreciate it. Chapter 26. The locomotive pulled only three cars through the forest. From his window in the passenger car, Lindstrom observed as the engineer brought it to a halt, hopped onto the tracks, and pulled a lever, switching tracks from the main line to a side track. The boilers fired up again, and the train began its journey through several miles of thick trees and covered the private estate in upstate New York. Lindstrom massaged his aching knuckles, his stomach a pit of despair. A round, short man was waiting at the small private depot when the train pulled in. Lindstrom stepped from the train and looked at the man with some hesitation.
"Is it on here?"
said Doyle, gesturing to the sealed freight cars. Lindstrom nodded. "Packed in ice, ready to be sent to the conservatory." The shorter man nodded.
"I read your reports. Interesting. We have some buyers from the Beak and Claws, but there's some interest in the ink, too. Some think we might be able to find a nasty poison in there. Perhaps something untraceable."
Lindstrom's interests were more medical than diabolical, despite his own machinations.
"I think the blood should be of particular interest. The creature can go long periods in freezing temperatures and still manage to pump blood to its heart and not freeze."
"Maybe. That's your man from Boston's secret, too, huh? Something in the blood?"
Lindstrom couldn't tell if Doyle was joking or not. The round little man was far more clever than he let on.
"I'm beginning to believe that his methods are something other than what I've suspected. His use of gadgetry and science make me think it's time to take another approach."
Lindstrom hoped that he could still prove useful to his employers. People who were no longer of service to them had a habit of either vanishing or becoming subjects of unpleasant experiments themselves. Doyle reached into his pocket and pulled out an envelope.
"You know they don't like exposure. The mess in Boston was most unpleasant. Some think you're getting too arrogant, treating rich dowagers and barging into police stations, trying to buffalo them and entrapping the man so you can poke around his basement. Clumsy!"
He pointed a stubby finger at the freight car.
"Letting one of those loose was a mistake."
Lindstrom's eyes narrowed.
"While I'll accept blame for that, the real cause was the late Mr. Reese, who I might remind you was assigned to me by them."
Lindstrom tilted his head in the direction of the huge mansion hidden by the trees.
"His methods were not my own. I had to deal with the aftermath. As far as the man in Boston is concerned, it seemed prudent to act on an opportunity."
His eyes drifted down to the envelope. Doyle shook his head.
"It's going to take a while before the repercussions of what they found in your basement die down. It's been decided that your skills could best be put to use elsewhere."
"Such as?" asked Lindstrom. Doyle tapped the edge of the envelope into his palm. "He's a German chemist. Been doing some interesting experiments with gases. Some obvious military implications. Unlike bullets, gas can find a soldier in a trench. We need someone to run the laboratory outside of Graz. We're curious of the effects some of these gases might have on human anatomy." "I am not interested in making weapons, Mr. Doyle," said Lindstrom in a terse voice. "I am a doctor, after all. My concerns have always been life." Doyle stepped toward him and poked a finger in Lindstrom's chest. "Your concern should be life, Dr. Lindstrom. Continuing to have one. You're not in a position right now to make requests. Personally, I think they're being far too lenient with you." Lindstrom realized that matters were as bad as he feared. He had no choice. He nodded to the man. His eyes drifted toward the road that led to the tall mansion. Inside its curtained windows were men he knew as little as he did about Smith. He feared them more than anyone else. Doyle handed him the envelope. "Tickets and passport." Lindstrom held the envelope in his hand like it was a sentence from a judge. Gone was the high life of Boston society, where he got to enjoy all the privileges of being a prestigious physician, catering to the wealthy and often lonely. "Don't be so glum. While you were focusing all your attention on the man himself, others were looking elsewhere. Made more headway than you have in the last several years. We've managed to obtain the records of all the supply houses that we know have been making regular shipments to the man in Boston." This was new to Lindstrom. "What of it?" "Some of those components can be used to make gases, like the ones our clients are interested in, for use on the battlefield, and for certain, let's say, hygienic purposes. A German scientist has a theory that I think you might find interesting. He thinks that certain gas mixtures might be used to not stop, but slow the body's biological functions."
"You mean like hibernation?" asked Lindstrom.
Doyle smiled. "Perfect, biologically rational explanation for our man in Boston, wouldn't you say? A chamber, perhaps, of some special mixture?" Lindstrom's weary face lit up. His life had been dedicated to dissecting and figuring out how creatures obtained their special evolutionary advantage. Now, he was present for an alternative explanation for the apparently preternatural man who called himself Smith.
"How soon may I leave?" he asked, eager to get as much distance from the mansion as possible.
Chapter 27 April watched as Smith sat on his desk and placed a piece of cardstock into his interpreter. He used a small brass tool to punch notches in it, in different places. "My mistake," he started, "was my assumption about where we were looking for."
"How do you mean?" asked April.
"I jumped to the conclusion a little bit too hastily when I saw the pins in the map."
"Did I do something wrong?"
Smith shook his head. No, not at all. The way you laid it out told me it was almost certainly that we were looking for an animal. I gave you a vial of ammonium because I suspected we were dealing with something of the sea. Initially, I thought it was some kind of amphibian and felt comfortable in the fog. The thick fog ruled out most land animals because few things would want to hunt out in it. Except, you know, the two-legged kind, of course."
"I'm not following you," said April. "What was your mistake?"
"It's why I had to kill it that night." Smith looked up from his brass machine. "That wasn't a hunting pattern, as I assumed. That was a nesting pattern."
"How so?"
"When I was down in the sewer, I didn't realize it at first, but the creature was acting very territorial. The pattern of the pins was what you'd expect from a creature seeking out prey in a limited area, and not a hunter ranging far and wide. I wanted a hunter. I saw a hunter. This thing was about to give birth to more creatures. Creatures born in the sewers, and about to be taught how to feed off what lived there." April thought about Broderick's story.
"Broderick said that was when Lindstrom's man, Reese, dissected the mate. He found eggs. So they weren't a breeding pair?
In some sea animals, the male can carry eggs. These things, however, appeared to be hermaphroditic, at least the one I dissected. It could either be one or the other, either way. When I carved it apart, I found an egg sac. They looked fairly well along, and there were hundreds of them. April shuddered at the thought of hundreds of those monsters loose in the sewers. My goodness. What of Lindstrom?
He collects things. He and his masters, the more exotic, the better. The poor creature we dispatched was just one more victim.
Poor creature? Asked April. She stole a glance at the metal door that he knew he was about to step behind. She wanted to stall him with questions.
What would you have done if someone killed something you loved? Let it go? Replied Smith.
Is that what the creature felt for the other? It seems like a rather alien emotion for such a beast, said April.
She'd watched as the men from MIT packed it up in preservatives to bury it away in some basement. Love, passion, they all have the same roots. Who knows what kind of bond the animals felt? But we call love an emotion that began millions of years ago.
We didn't invent it. We named it. Refined it, perhaps.
He pulled the card free and gave it a flick with his finger and knocked free any punches that were still hanging to it. He fed it into the slot on his desk. He turned a handle and looked up at April, who had been sitting across from him at her desk, staring at him.
Don't look so forlorn, Miss Malone. I'm sure they'll catch up with Dr. Lindstrom after what they found in his basement of the apothecary shop. Human remains from the pauper cemetery. How grotesque!
Smith placed another card into his interpreter and began notching holes. April gave him a skeptical look.
I'm sure you and Mr. Broderick had nothing to do with that.
Miss Malone, I am shocked by the accusation.
He looked back at the card punch. Only returning what he'd brought.
Fool.
Will you be attending the service for the people they found in its gullet?
Smith shook his head.
I've seen enough death.
I think they'd like to see the hero who killed it, she said.
And they will, Miss Malone.
You. If you hadn't ventured down after me and shot the umbrella at it, I never would have made it out alive, and we'd have no proof to show what was down there. And it was you that figured out how to stop it.
He looked back up at her.
You really are quite remarkable.
April looked away, hiding her blush. Something mechanical made a sound from within Smith's desk. A card popped out. He held it up and looked at it in the light of the gas lamp. He shook his head.
Is the matter still unresolved? Your elliptical problem? She asked.
The current one is righted. One of the longer-term ones. The reason this all began, sadly.
No. April tried to read his face. He talked in circles without trying.
I see.
He leaned back in his chair.
I know I must be a cipher to you, Miss Malone. Tell you what, I trust you and your integrity. Ask me anything you like. Any question at all, and you'll have the truth. You've certainly earned it.
April looked at the metal door and then back at him. She stared directly at him with her piercing blue eyes.
Will I ever see you again?
Smith took in a breath and then looked down at his hands.
Yes. Yes, Miss Malone.
He sunk down in his seat and looked toward the window. But don't wait for me. He pushed another card into his desk and waited for it to spit back out. The two of them sat in silence. The card finally returned, and he crumpled it up and threw it on the floor. He placed his elbows on his desk, rubbed his temples as he stared at the interpreter.
This isn't what I've chosen for myself, he said softly.
It's not what I wanted. Not this way. Smith stood up and walked over to the metal door and pulled it open. April left her desk to hold it open. Smith gave her a grin.
Until next time, Miss Malone.
She reached out and pulled him by the collar and placed a kiss on his cheek, leaving a bright red blotch of lipstick.
Until next time.
They both looked away, embarrassed. The door closed behind him, and locking mechanisms whirled into place. April stood there for a while, with her hand on the door. After 5 months, she'd stopped looking at the metal door every day when she sat in the office. She continued her work, filling the coffee pot, getting pastries that would get thrown out, reading, filing, and all the other things that were part of her routine. She had a better idea of how important these trivial bits of knowledge were, so she filed them all away, even the most mundane things. Smith had showed her even the smallest detail could have grave importance. Sometimes she could feel machinery below the floorboards come alive. She'd looked at the 3 light bulbs above the door, hoping they would come on. But they didn't. Sometimes she pressed her ear to the door, trying to listen for anything beyond it. Once, she thought, but only fleetingly, that she could hear the sound of a child's laughter. She found time to continue acting, although it wasn't anything she wanted to pursue beyond a hobby. She was cast in a local production and took the role when she was convinced it wouldn't conflict with her working hours. It was a small production by a local playwright, but it seemed a coincidence. Sergeant Robertson was cast in the male lead. April played his outspoken daughter. Most nights, the house was half empty, but the players gave it their best, no matter how small the crowd. On closing night, she looked out into the crowd as the cast members took their bows, and she thought she saw a familiar face. As soon as the curtains went up, she raced out into the theater, still in her costume, to the street outside. She saw a figure walking down the dark side of the street and ran up to him. The man heard her footsteps and turned around.
"Oh, hello, Miss Malone," said Mr. Cohen. "You startled me."
April looked around the street. Other than the crowd waiting for the carriages under the light of the marquee, there was no one else there.
"Hello, Mr. Cohen," she said out of breath. "I'm delighted you could make it."
"You were wonderful."
Robertson, continuing his paternal role, caught up with her. He looked over at Mr. Cohen and nodded.
"Well, good evening," said Cohen.
He smiled and then continued walking down the sidewalk.
"Are you all right, April?"
asked Robinson.
"Yes. Yes, I'm fine."
Robertson gave her a knowing look. He put a hand on her shoulder and guided her back to the theater. April stole another glance behind her. All she could see was Cohen fading into the dark.
"I shouldn't be telling you this, and don't ask me how I know," said Robertson with a wink. "But I think Mr. Cohen is our benefactor that paid for our play."
"Benefactor?" said April.
"Didn't you know? 1 week into rehearsals, and someone stepped forward to make sure we got the full run at a nice theater. Not that second-rate vaudeville shack they do the other plays in. Nice man, that Mr. Cohen."
Robertson waved to a woman waiting under the marquee. Epilogue. 2 months later, April felt the floor vibrating below her. She resisted the urge to put her ear next to the door. She continued reading the copy of National Geographic that had arrived for her. She turned a page and read with genuine interest about a race of cannibals on the island of Borneo. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the first red light turn on. April forgot to breathe. The second light came on. April hesitantly stood up and straightened her dress. She looked down at her feet to make sure she was wearing proper shoes this time. The third light came on. From behind the door came a clicking sound as sliding rods unlocked. The door slowly swung open, revealing darkness beyond. April touched her hair to make sure it was in place. Footsteps ran up the stairs. A shape emerged from the shadows, and a disheveled Smith emerged. He bolted into the room, and his eyes locked on hers, and he smiled. April put a hand on her mouth. Her cheeks felt on fire. He read the card in his hand.
"Hello! It says here my name is Smith."
He looked at her with a hopeful look.
"Have we met?"
April noticed the lipstick mark on his cheek. It was the same place where she'd last kissed him goodbye.
Oh, dear, said Smith. Are you all right, Miss...
This has been an audiobook presentation of The Chronological Man, A Monster in the Mist, by Andrew Main. Read by Justin Robert Young. If you have enjoyed this reading, please support the author by reviewing The Chronological Man on the Amazon page by searching The Chronological Man. You might also enjoy audiobook presentations of Andrew Main's The Grendel Shadow and Public Enemy Zero. We hope you have enjoyed this program.
This program was recorded and engineered by Eric Taylor Young.